Good morning, everybody. Good morning, especially to our colleagues in New Zealand. Welcome, Kimberly. First of all, may I express on behalf of the whole board our deep condolences for the passing away of Tony Dale so unexpectedly. It must have been a really bitter blow. And we're really sorry we don't have him in our midst anymore.
Thank you.
Kimberly, would you like to present your group to us and we can start our meeting?
Thanks, Hans. Firstly, myself, Kimberly Crook, Chair of the New Zealand Accounting Standards Board, which is a sub-board of the External Reporting Board, or XRB, and I'm joined with three staff from the XRB team. Firstly, on my left, Todd Spedsworth, the Director of Accounting Standards, also Lisa Kelsey and Clive Brody, two of the accounting standards staff team who did all the heavy lifting in terms of putting together these papers for you today.
Okay, excellent. So how do we start?
I can just give you a brief introduction of the papers we're looking at in the disclosure initiative today, and then I'll pass over to the New Zealand team because they're leading first. So we've got a number of papers on the disclosure initiative today. We'll be starting with the New Zealand papers, which are papers 11F to 11I. And then we'll move into the principles of disclosure papers after the break. So that's the content of notes 11E and aggregation of information. And then finally, we'll move to materiality, which will be papers 11B and 11A. So with that sort of brief introduction of the disclosure initiative papers today, I'll pass over to the New Zealand team to take us through agenda papers 11F to 11I.
Over to you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for that, Christy. So yes, our four papers today, we're going to focus primarily on paper 11F, which essentially summarises the content in the papers and provides the questions to the board. So as I explained in that paper, the work that we've been doing is of course part of the Principle of Disclosures project. And our particular part was to look at a couple of existing standards to come up with essentially a new proposed approach to drafting disclosure requirements. So the particular standards we looked at were IAS 16, property, plant and equipment, and IFRS 3 on business combinations. And those were chosen really because in some ways they're quite different standards, and that's one's an old standard, one's a relatively new standard. One deals with assets, whereas the other deals with a transaction that has occurred during the reporting period. So really to give us a range of standards so that we could develop an approach that would be broadly applicable across the suite of standards. In developing the proposed approach, we thought about, well, what are the problems today? What is the problem we're seeking to resolve? And I think there were a couple of, in our early discussions of ISB staff, there were a couple of real key issues that emerged. One was around the lack of clear objectives, particularly in older standards like IAS 16, where it's not clear to people applying the standard what the purposes of particular disclosure requirements, and therefore why is that particular disclosure going to be useful to users. So that makes it difficult for people to know what to provide and whether particular items of information are material. The other issue was around prescriptive wording, particularly when accompanied by long lists of disclosure requirements, because that can encourage a compliance or a checklist type approach, whereas of course what we're trying to focus on is people providing useful information as opposed to a compliance approach. So what we ended up with, and the first thing we did was look at the objectives area and developed an approach that has an overall objective for the disclosure section of the standard and also has sub-objectives for each group of disclosures. And we developed that based on the conceptual framework. So the idea is if you look at a particular disclosure requirement, that will then link back to the sub-objective for that group of disclosures, which will link back to the overall objective to the standard, which in turn will link back to the conceptual framework and other aspects of the disclosure project. We then also looked around the way that the disclosure requirements are drafted and essentially to turn it so there's much more emphasis on the exercise of judgment in several ways. Firstly, to encourage entities to exercise their judgment in determining the extent and mix of disclosure requirements. And you'll see that we have a section at the start of each of the standards that does emphasise that exercise of judgment. Now, you might think about where that's best located, whether it needs to be in say, IS1 or in each standard. That's not really the purpose of today's discussion. It's really just to get your views on that guidance around the exercise of judgment. Secondly, we've used less prescriptive wording. In fact, I guess we've gone the opposite extreme. If it's prescriptive today, we've gone the other way and made it very principles-based to show you what that looks like, and we do recognise that that itself comes with its own set of challenges, which are acknowledged in the paper. In addition, we've divided things up between general and additional disclosure requirements. And the idea behind that was that the general requirements would essentially give you an overview of property, plant and equipment if you're talking about IS 16, or business combinations if you're talking about IFRS 3, like a broad brush picture of that particular item. And then that's supplemented by the additional disclosure requirements, which really fill in the picture and give you that greater level of detail and information. And the extent of that additional information would, of course, depend on the relative importance of the particular item. The next steps, once we've got your feedback, would be to talk to others, to get some feedback on the workability of the approach in practice, which we would like to do before the discussion paper is published before the end of the year. So that's the broad introduction. I'd like to turn to the questions that are in paper 11F, with the first set of questions appearing at the top of page 5, just before paragraph 15, which relates to the idea about having objectives and sub-objectives. So perhaps at this point, if I can pass back to Hans and Alan, it might be easier for you to take the board through the questions.
All right. Any comments? Mary?
I'll start, and Kimberly, I'll start by saying I've thought that the hardest piece of this entire project has been how to give people more anchors for determining materiality of disclosure. And it's that, you know, what is the basis when it's a qualitative discussion? And we've identified a number of things. It's not like it doesn't depend solely on the materiality of the item, you know, of the related line item. And I think that you've really, this work does a tremendous amount to say, okay, it's here. And I think that here is the specification of the sub-objectives along with a description of why that information would be useful to users of financial statements, because I think that gives somebody who's trying to make a determination of materiality a benchmark to say this is why or why not I think it's material. So I think it's the right way to go. I think in terms of structure and organizing, you noted in your TF comments that you could talk about whether the objective, you know, both the you focused on the use of judgment as being either in an IS1 type document or in each standard, and I think both the use of judgment and also the actually the overall the overall objective seems to me to be something that could be said once, essentially, because I think it would be essentially the same for each standard. The objective for disclosure for each standard is, you know, is to ensure that fill in the subject of the standard, and then it's the same words. But I think it's the sub-objectives that really make it come alive, as well as the explanation of why this information, how this information would be used by users of financial statements. So I think that's the right package to move us forward.
Now, I think I do agree with the overall rationale for developing this approach. I think it's very useful to have a main objective and sub-objective to explain or to amplify each main objective. I'm not sure I would agree fully with the examples which are provided to illustrate this approach. I think there is a lot of discussions about, for instance, paragraph 11 regarding IS 16, whether the objective is only to enable to understand the effect CPNE has on the financial position. I think probably I would describe it as a broader objective. I would go beyond that, but I think it's another level of discussion. I think we should at this stage maybe stick to the overall approach and not go too much into the illustration. I think the idea is not to discuss how we can phrase each objective. It's more to set the level of the general approach, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. And a couple of points on that. So when we worked with New Zealanders on this, it was getting the drafting right. And we always knew there was a risk of two things. One, the point that Mary raises and the point that you're raising. One is, where do we put the disclosures? And geographically, some of these might fit better into one standard, and perhaps some of the more specific things in individual standards, and that's something to do in the future. But we're working within the current constraints and try to get one to one page. Yeah. And the second one is, you're absolutely right, Philippe, the real challenge for any review of disclosure requirements is you actually have to think about what the standard's trying to do in the first place. Mm-hmm. And so you could be challenging exactly the rationale for why something should be there, or you're saying, well, something's missing. Our real focus today is to say, have we got the right sort of drafting? Because if this works well, we're eventually, when we do the standard by standard review, we're going to need a bit of a toolkit or a template to think about how we approach each standard, and that's what we're trying to get out of it today. Then we can actually work on the actual content and relate them back to the objectives and the framework.
Just to illustrate my point, I think if I look at a set of financial statements, I probably want to understand not only the effect, the financial effect, but also the role that PP&E plays in the business activities, not to use business model, of the entity. I want to understand whether the entity is buying its property or leasing its property, whether it is capital intensive or capital light, whether there is a fast rotation, replacement of the fixed assets, or whether it is long-term assets, all that I want to understand through the financial statements. And then the effect in terms of position is the result of that. But I want to understand what's before the effect. So I think we could at the time we review each disclosure, discuss that.
Yeah, so Kimberly, to that point, I think Philippe's issue about you want to understand you know, is a high turnover and things like that, and how it works. That would be more the general requirements, I think, isn't it? So it's understanding how important PP&E is to your organisation, mm-hmm. and so on, because I don't know if it's the right term or trigger or filter, but from that, that should actually be a bit of a guise to see whether you expect to see more or less sub-disclosures or secondary disclosures.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, more context.
Sorry,
yeah.
Christy. Yeah. Gregor?
Again, the paragraph 11, you know. I will view this paragraph better than the current ones we used for many years. You know, I checked the recently published financial accounting standards, and we normally quite often use the word the effect on the cash, the timing, uncertain day, and what the risk. And I always quite feel, you know, unclear whether that means. Of course, people will say, you know, because our second level of objectives is defined this way. But if you look at the whole standards, it's not only, you know, purely related to cash flow, you can say indirectly, but I would prefer this expert question, that is effect on property and the financial position, financial performance, and the cash flow. My question is whether this will be in the future a general description everywhere, or alternatively, like Philippe, he wants a more detailed, more specific description. My understanding is this will be a uniform expression. I'm right?
Well, that's the question. I think it's back to Mary's point, isn't it, about this type of wording might fit more comfortably into a general standard and be more generic. Otherwise, you could actually say that if I put square brackets around property, plant, and equipment in that, I could then every standard I go to, I can just put in that the same thing. So that's a geography issue about whether we do that. So there are two issues there. One, where it goes, and two, whether or not the board thinks that's a better way of expressing what the disclosure objectives is more generally. And both of those have to be debated, I think. We're trying to get the right general direction now.
My second simple question is, I feel the word sufficient, you know, quite strange, you know. We normally would not use such kind of word, because every time we use a word which representing some level, then people question, you know, what does that word mean? Yeah. No, we can discuss further, you know.
Sue?
Thanks, firstly, well done on a very good set of papers. It was really helpful for me to understand what we've been talking about when we've been talking about objective-based standards, and I don't know whether the team in New Zealand know or not, but I've been the one who's been sort of one of the ones being cautious about how general the objectives might be and what the effect might be in terms of the quality of financial reporting, and I got a lot of comfort from what you'd drafted, because I think that the way that it's worded, it should promote good behaviour, and I think it's still pretty clear what our expectations are, I guess. And the other thing I just wanted to say was I agree with the general approach you've got here with the overriding objective and then the sub-objectives. I'm not going to talk about sort of words at this point. I don't think it's time for it. But the other thing that struck me when I was reading the papers, which I think is another good thing about this type of approach, is I think not only would it be helpful for people, to Mary's point, trying to think about what should they provide to provide a good set of financial statements, but I think it really made me stop and think about why particular types of information was important for us to be asking people to provide. It was a really good discipline for me to stop and think, well, why do we want that information? What do we think we're going to get out of it? And so that gives me hope that in the future when we're writing these requirements, it might be a good way of creating discipline for us and thinking about what we require or, you know, suggest from a disclosure perspective, rather than just, I think we ourselves are guilty of a checklist approach. We think of a whole list of stuff we'd like to know about, and we don't take a step back and think about what it is we're actually trying to get explained to users of financial statements. So I think this approach to drafting will actually improve our standard setting and decision making, not just help people applying our standards, and I think that's important as well.
Pat?
Following on Sue's comments, I completely agree. I think the team, Alan, Christy, Kimberly, and the others in New Zealand have done an outstanding job in terms of framing the issues that need to be considered in developing a disclosure standard, and kind of an omnibus general standard, as well as the components or elements that would go into an element-specific standard like PP&E, or a transaction-specific standard like say, business combinations. So I'm very pleased with the direction of this. One of the questions that I had when I read this, but Alan has identified, I think, a key point here. One of my concerns was that there might be too much exercise in the use of judgment, and there might not be enough clarity around when you need to actually provide certain information. And I think anchoring it in how important it is to your business is a good way to do that. I've said many times here at the board table, materiality for many analysts is something that is a relative issue for them, because in a digital environment, they don't feel constrained by trying to fit information on an A4 set of piece of paper. You know, most analysts, their models can be 500, 750 lines long, and with the beauty of Excel, you can either click on something and expand a cell, or you can collapse it. So you can have as much data as you want. The notion that you can overload the analyst with data, in my mind, is a complete fiction. So at the end of the day, the exercise of judgment is going to be critical to whether you're in, you know, this model. I think where the real value in the thinking that they've developed here lies in the sub-objectives, and as Alan just pointed out, going into that in more detail, I think, is going to be critical. And Sue actually captured, I think, really the important kind of thought process. You have to evaluate what is important for the reader of the financial statement in this particular area. And I always like to think of that in the context of the following kind of paradigm. What is management asserting with respect to this element on the balance sheet? What is the auditor attesting to with respect to this element on the balance sheet? And that's the information that the investor wants to know about, whether it's cash or PP&E or accounts payable. One of the big gaps in GAAP I've always felt is the changes in elements on the balance sheet have to be broken down and disaggregated between cash components and non-cash components. So if you give me a reconciliation of PP&E and it says additions and subtractions, it really isn't a lot of value, okay? if you're going to start breaking it down between obsolescence, credit purchases, credit sales, things like that, that's a huge improvement. But at the end of the day, what's it all about? It's all about predicting how earnings transform or translate into the generation of cash and wealth. And unless you can do that on an element-by-element basis, the financial statements become kind of a puzzle. It's a conundrum that you have to try to figure out. How is this entity generating cash? Where is it coming from? Well, if your sub-objectives are going to outline that and provide that information, to the extent it's material, to the extent it's important, then you've hit a home run. You've done a great job here. Okay? So I'm very pleased with the direction of this.
You? Yes, thank you very much indeed for some very good papers. I just want to make a point about the geographic location of the overall or general objective, and I just wonder how possible it would be to include it in a single disclosure standard, because there are certain disclosures which will not have a material impact on the primary financial statements, but which nonetheless are material. We want to make those disclosures for other reasons. Related parties would be one example. So I think we need to give that a little bit of thought before concluding that we would go for one location for that.
Stephen? So I like the greater focus on objectives and sub-objectives. I think that's good. I prefer the objective in paragraph 11 to what we have at the moment. I've never really liked this sole focus on amount timing uncertainty of future cash flows. I think it was very difficult to interpret and apply. My concern is, and Kimberly noted it, that this is moving to the opposite extreme in terms of principles based. And in particular, the word consider in terms of the individual disclosure requirements. Because I recall when we discussed this with CMAC some time ago, and we talked about changing the word should to consider or some such phrase like that, and they reacted with horror, I think all of them, because they said, that's not going to work, and we're not going to get the disclosures that we want. So I think we have to be very cautious about going down this route and going to the opposite extreme, because we have to be confident that companies are still going to deliver the disclosures and that the regulatory and the audit process will work appropriately to deliver those disclosures. And I think the investors that we have on the CMAC were extremely skeptical about the ability of this approach to deliver what they need.
Which paragraph are you referring to with this consider, Steve?
I'm not quite sure which paragraph. Well, it's mentioned several places, isn't it?
Paragraph
13
in paper.
This line of the
all through private
GM. Get your feedback from, you're going to talk to regulators, I presume, as part of the outreach in terms of
enforceability. Yeah. So I was going to finish with the next steps, but I'll just to assure you that we're running a workshop in Tokyo in June, and New Zealand is going across for that as well with the standard setters. So we'll get feedback there. But the CMAC and the consumers, they're not the ones working with it. The ones who work with it, like repairers, regulators and auditors, one we have to field test with. And I think the other comment I would have is, in a way, we've sort of talked in abstract about this up until now, and I think we could perhaps go back to CMAC, for example, because and see whether they might think about this as being more favourably once they actually see some words expressed, and in particular explaining why we think information is helpful to them, because we're almost speaking on their behalf. So I think we've made, I think, a lot more progress, because it's from an abstract concept to something that we're tangible now.
Can I make one more point about digital reporting and some of the comments that Pat made? Pat said we're not constrained by A4 paper, and absolutely agree. But in my experience, investors like structured information. They know what they expect from a set of financial statements. So at the moment, for PP&E, we have pretty structured information because we have a PP&E roll forward. And although the columns and rows might vary, I think it doesn't change that much. And people know roughly where to look in the financial statements, roughly what they're going to find, and extracting information that they need, fixed asset purchases, whatever it is relatively efficient. And my concern with this is that we lose that structure. Now, I know principles-based approach should ensure that we have something which is proportionate to the importance of PP&E and we have the relevant line items, but we could go to the opposite extreme and end up with users flicking through financial statements trying to locate that particular bit of information because that structure is lost that we currently have.
Can I just jump in on that? I had a similar reaction when I read paper F, but then when I got to paper G, my understanding is that that kind of information that Stephen just identified would be covered in the sub-objectives under changes in property, plant, and equipment. So I'm looking at page 8 of paper 11G, where that kind of detail appears, and this is where I think the critical part of this model lies, is are you going to, in fact, always get the additional information when something is important to a business? That, I think Stephen's hit the nail on the head, and that's been one of my concerns too, is if it's important to the business, the analysts have to have this information, and they have to have it in this kind of structure consistently. So if that's your intent, that's why I'm, you know, full speed ahead on this. But if it's not, you know, you might get it, you might not, then it's a different kettle of fish.
Stephen, you mentioned, you know, sort of a half, one extreme to the other. How could we get to a halfway house? Using principles but getting the information you want.
It was the word consider that I tripped up on. Consider think seems to me like, well, think about it, but you know.
I don't know if it's a halfway house, but there may be some of these particular disclosures, like you know that if you're going to do a roll forward, we could give some structure around it. I think there's still this issue about mechanically, you know, like why do some banks have to show roll forwards and all their PP&E when it's immaterial to the business, for example. And so we've got to be careful we don't go to an extreme to say everything's about should consider. I think this is saying, I think to Pat's point, there's enough structure in paragraph 10 to indicate on, well, this is on paper 11G, paragraph 10, there's enough structure in there to suggest that this is, if it is important, give it some structure. And what these, the A, B, C, D, et cetera, is doing is identifying potential rows or columns that you might have within there, that you've got to consider whether that's important enough to actually express in there. So I think that it's not a halfway house, but I think that where structure is important, we should impose structure.
I think fundamentally, if you apply materiality properly, it shouldn't matter whether that says you shall consider or it says shall. You should end up with the same disclosure. So it's what is going to be the best language to get you to apply materiality in the way that it should be applied. And some people might think it's the consider, some people might be the shall.
So what you really mean is it should consider the materiality of disclosing.
I think it's the enforceability for me.
Is
it not? In paper 11F, in paragraphs 11 and 12, there's very absolute statements. This standard requires that an entity disclose the following. And then in meeting that absolute statement, these are the things you should consider. And I think that's the context that you see the consider in. The two absolute statements that come in paragraph 11 and 12 for 16 and 3. And then the consider is just how you think about you would actually meet those absolute requirements.
The other thing that this draws out is the application of comparability. And it's an issue that we're looking at a later paper, but I think what you're talking about is to what extent do we want to provide, I don't know, to what extent should comparability between entities be something that's sort of, how does that work with relevance?
Take, for example, fixed asset purchases. Mm-hmm. Basic key bit of information for an investor. Under what circumstances would we expect a company not to disclose that? I think it would have to be immaterial.
Yeah.
In all other circumstances, I think it should be there. Does consider plus the objective ensure that in all of those circumstances it is there? And it's got to be in an accessible position. So there's 100 pages of financial statements. It can't be at some random place in there. It's got to be that it's easy to identify what that number is.
In terms of the discussion paper, would we be happy to go with consider and then ask a specific question to actually use it as the basis? Or
well, we're going to do the field testing first.
Yeah, okay.
And I think we should probably look at that, because as I say, there may be some cases where you might need to be a little bit more specific in the, either the terminology or the structure. In other cases, the consider may well be appropriate. So I think we need
Alan, can I perhaps add a little to that? Yeah, it's certainly our intention that it'll be a key part of the field testing before publication of discussion paper, to look at that very point, and I'm certainly very conscious of you know, a lot of the comments that Steve has made there about are you really going to get the right outcomes if we go very principles based, and I think that is something we're very conscious of, does need some further thought and testing on people. If I take off my stand setting hat and put my practitioner hat on from an auditor perspective, I have those similar concerns. So we are conscious of that, and a lot of what we've done here could still be presented very much as we've got it today, but tighten up the wording. If we find that that's a little bit loose and it needs tightening up, we would look at doing that and bring that back to you before it actually gets published in the discussion paper.
But there is a risk too. When we met a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about this, and if you tighten up the wording too much, look at IS16, you would then create a mega tick box, and all of a sudden you've got even a worse problem, because we've been quite expanded the objectives and given lots of examples and being very specific with the wording, it's going to be a worse problem than we have now. Okay. So there's a bit of a trade-off.
Can I just say something about field testing? I think no amount of field testing of this is actually going to get to a realistic assessment of whether this will work in practice, because you field test it and people are going to produce stuff that they know you want to see. The only real field test is once you've issued a standard with this in. And I would suggest that if we're going to go down this route, the true field test is to try it with a new standard. And you have then 3 years of field test with an actual standard. Don't apply it to anything else. And then you've got the ability to roll it back in a post-implementation review.
Do it on leasing, you think, Steve?
Well, that's already quite objective-based, the way we tried to draft the lease or the decisions that we made, so that will be a test case.
John Wu.
Thank you. First of all, I would like to say many, many thanks to your big contribution to this project. Thank you, New Zealand. And a couple of questions. The first one is maybe related to the Weigel's comment. On paragraph 13 and 14, you raised the kind of the amounts of cash flows and uncertainties. Is there any reason why you skipped timing of cash flows in this objective? That's the first question on your nice paper. Another one is we are going to deal with the framework of this for developing objective of sub-objectives in our paper 11E. That's 11E paragraph 28-29. There are two approaches. The one is an information type approach. Another one is a kind of a user perspective approach. I'm just questioning, what approach do you have in mind in developing this specific examples of IAS 16 and IFRS 3? It looks to me, you are kind of combining these two approaches. Maybe that looks like consistent with our step recommendation. But let me hear what you are thinking about these two general approaches. Another thing is on the Steve's comments, whether we are deleting some kind of prescriptive languages in our old IFRS standards. That's why you are using some considers with some kind of a topic paragraph, there you use require. So it's a kind of a reflection of our previous decision or existing decisions of the IASB on this disclosure. So we need to kind of maybe additional effort to make all preparers be maybe provide some good additional, maybe some good disclosures about their performance conditions. But I guess you are just following our general direction of on this kind of languages. So I respect your effort on this, but we have to think about it more carefully in kind of enforceability, such kind of issues. So generally, I would like to say thank you on this kind of contribution, and the general direction is very nice. So it will be very helpful to us for our future deliberations. Thank you.
Look, can I offer my
Kimberly
is going to
go
first.
Yes, please.
Sorry, I was just going to say in the questions that were asked, the first one about missing out the word timing of cash flows, that certainly wasn't deliberate, and obviously that will be tidied up to be consistent. The second question, in terms of its relationship with the what's been presented in the other papers, I think probably best for Alan or Christie to answer that question, since they'll be obviously much closer to what they've developed there, so I'll let them answer that question.
So in terms of 11E, I would say that this approach reflects more the type of information approach, and it's sort of based on the same objectives and disclosures. But ultimately, this is about drafting and the way we draft the disclosure requirements. So I would hope that whatever approach we take in terms of the framework, the drafting aspects would still apply. But if I had to say which one flows through in those two approaches, it would be the one that has the information.
I think we have two ways to solve this issue. One way is keep using shall or should consistently. But clearly said in the general standards, you know, this requirement is subject to materiality, subject to the circumstances of the entity. For example, let's assume in IS1 in the future, or revised one, we still have cost of goods sold. For banking industry, it's meaningless. And similarly, even financial instruments, maybe a particular traditional bank don't have so many complicated derivatives. And even though we require a lot of disclosure, but that company may, or that bank may not, it's not necessary for the bank to disclose. So if we say so, to distinguish shall or consider, make no sense. You understand what I want to say? I remember before I joined the board, maybe Philippe was also there. Our school standing committee one discussed a lot of time about whether the auditing standards should be improved. Main debate is whether there is a difference between shall and should, and may or shall. And then finally, I remember those non-English speaking members, including myself and Philippe, said, oh, I understand. Please, the English speaking member countries, you debate yourself, because people have different understanding. And in Australia, shall may be much stronger than should. But in another English-speaking country, they say that no, we interpret differently. So in my view, you know, distinction between shall, should, and consider make no sense unless if we clearly say, no, even though we use shall, should in these standards, I would like to keep this. But you know, whether a particular entity should disclose or not, it depends on materiality, depends on the circumstances of the company. And the issue will be over.
Doc?
Thank you. Let me come back to the Stephen's concern. Are we going to the other extreme or not? And Stephen's concern is, are we losing structured requirements? On this point, I just would like to point out, I think what we are seeking for is communication rather than compliance. And the preparers are now really struggling why this particular piece of information is necessary for the users, and how do they use it to analyze our company. And if they knew it more, then they would provide better information to satisfy the users' need. So I think in this sense, New Zealand friends are challenging very well. This is written on the paragraph 11 of paper 11G. And that they provided the table of the what the users are using for the particular information. Those kind of information would be very helpful for preparers to make a substantial good judgment so that respond to the users' needs. Of course, there is another challenging issue. How can we assure the comparability? However, if the notes disclosure is kind of the communication, then that is the way we should go.
Martin.
Yeah. I think if he's, I think one of the problem of this disclosure overload or not relevant sufficient disclosure is okay, materiality, wrong application of materiality. I think the solution must be that we go more to an objective-based disclosure requirement, because otherwise it is difficult for preparers to say okay to apply materiality if you don't know what the objective is. I agree to that, but I also have concerns like Stephen has said, but also from the preparer's perspective, because if you have to produce financial statements for a multinational company with, I don't know, 500 reporting entities into a group and then apply materiality judgment on objectives every year end or quarter end, I think is also a difficult task. And I think it is more structured and systematically possible to do if you really have kind of structured requirements which you can roll out through your reporting entities and then ask, please provide me with this information every quarter or year end, instead of making judgments all of that. Because if you have to make judgment, you have to document that, auditors would require that, and it's really difficult process. So I think it's really important that if we're doing a field test, that is not only from the, I think, users on auditors' side, is also really from the preparer side, because is that approach operational really for multinational companies? That is where I struggling a little bit. But I agree, and what I said earlier is really, if we think it is a problem of people or preparers don't apply materiality for disclosure, then the only way is to give objective. But I think the big advantage is if we go this route, it is not only for preparers, it is for us. Because if we cannot come up with, okay, what is the specific objective, why we requiring disclosure, I think that is bad. And therefore, that is at least, I think, for us, brings discipline what we are thinking, okay, what we're requiring.
But in itself, it should be possible to have more principle-based requirements and at the same time retain clear structure.
Yeah.
Because I do see the advantages of retaining clear structure in the notes, both for preparers.
But to find the right balance is tricky, I think, and that is.
Yes. But for most of these disclosures, I don't think you need to make a quarterly assessment. The example that Alan always uses about PP&E for banks, there will not likely be a time that becomes.
Yeah, but my point is, material. Based on my experience, but then the auditors will ask you for that. Please come up why you have to make this judgment every, maybe not every quarter, but every year end to document, okay, that it is maybe not material, and that is a lot of more work.
But the general disclosure requirement and objective that's spelled out in each of these is supposed to be kind of helping you with a filter, so that rather than prepare all the information and then say, well, it's actually not material, you pass through a little gateway that says, how important is this to your entity? So that's the idea, is trying to really give a focus for that question itself.
And my point is also not that preparers may be questioning disclosure overload that they have to prepare then the financial statements. The question, the issue is also, mind, you have to have the information available. You have to program in the systems. If it becomes material, then okay, you must have the information. You cannot wait until end of the year and then by that and say, okay, this material. If since there isn't disclosure requirement, you have to make sure that if it becomes material, you have this information in a multinational group with 500 companies. And that is a kind of people thinking, okay, it is too costly. That is not only that somebody is sitting there and deciding, okay, what I put into the financial statement. It is the overall preparatory work which you have to have, because if information is material, that you are available to report this information.
On this point, I have a different opinion. I don't think we have to wait for the end of the year. Management knows what is real important element of the management. And they know these are the area which are important, and they are monitoring all the time. So therefore, I don't think we have to wait until the end of the year.
Stephen, you wanted to get back here?
Yeah, please, the word importance. So a gateway is, how important is it? What's the definition of importance? Are we going to have an importance problem instead of a materiality problem?
That was just me being using a little bit of shorthand in our discussion, because as Kimberly and the team have very carefully laid out, it's things like, it is the relative importance of the organisation, and it will be to do with the amounts and how critical it is to their business, for example, and whether there's estimation uncertainty involved and things like that. They actually spell that out in the general objective.
But isn't that materiality?
Well, it is, but what we're saying is have a look at something like PPN, and we keep using PPN. We did that the same with the IFRS Foundation. We can answer those basic questions. This is put on an example. We actually didn't put the level of purchases, I think, for property, plant, and equipment and financial statements this year for the foundation, because they were clearly not material. And that was kind of our gateway question ourselves. So I don't want to use the word important. It is. I guess you're right, it's whether it's material. But even then, they say, what do you mean by material? It will be how critical it is or essential it is to the organisation, the relative amounts, all those other qualitative characteristics go into it. But it's a high-level question you ask. It goes back to things like the primary financial statements. If you're looking at that, that's a window into the organisation. You should be able to see the relative balance of assets, liabilities, and so on, and then you should... we hope anyway, there's going to be some likelihood that you want to see more about some of those and a lot more about other aspects.
Maybe Gary, about the materiality of the topic to the information as a whole.
Anyways, thank you. With the risk of not repeating too much of what's been said, one thing worth repeating, though, is I think there's a job well done by the entire New Zealand team and the disclosure team. And I do agree with the overall approach in this paper. And I really think it's something preparers and their auditors, and the engagement team auditors, can work with. As you step back and think about it, I think, right now, we generally don't have objectives and sub-objectives in most standards and most topics. And I think the absence of that is one of the things that begatted the checklist approach. I do think that this will shift our future debate on disclosures to more of what's the objectives and sub-objectives as opposed to the line item bullet content. And I think it will perhaps change when we discuss disclosures, because I think through many of our papers, I shouldn't say most, is you go through subtopic by subtopic in a standard. You've got recognition, you've got measurement, you've got other factors than disclosures. And so you sort of agree on most of the disclosures piecemeal, they get parking lot, and then you go back and do an overall disclosure. But I think we'll change a bit in the flow of our work, and it's a good thing, because I think when you've got objectives and sub-objectives, I think it gives structure, you know, and meaning to what you're trying to do, and helps you filter materiality and the other judgmental things that are there. I do agree with some of the comments people made about the need for structure, and it can't be so totally free-form, but I should probably point out, I think preparers like structure too, is in terms of what data you're going to gather from your business units, but also good preparers, they know what their analysts and other users are likely to ask, and the reality is you assume answer them once in your annual report and not have to take questions throughout the year because they know what's important. So structure's important for repairers too. At this point, I think, Christy, there's an awful lot of moving parts in the entire disclosure initiative, and I think it's perhaps more important now to get the overall model and construct right than it is most the individual details that are there. But for this piece of it, I think we've hit it really good.
Mary?
Thinking about some of the points raised, and you know, I also had a more detailed comment concern about just throwing out the word considers, and this, but that's as a drafting point rather than as a fundamental objection. I think we have to remember two negative experiences and maybe even cite them explicitly as we go ahead with this. One is the experience that encouraged but not required disclosures produce zero in response. You know, so when our experience is when we have said the following disclosure is not required but it's encouraged, we see virtually no response to that. And so I think we have to make it clear that that's not what we are saying, that this is an encouraged disclosure. I think we have to be explicit. And I think Darrell had a very good way of framing it when he said there is a disclosure requirement. And what we're trying to do is move to less prescriptive language along with an explanation of our thinking in terms of identifying what we think normally often will be responsive to these requirements to allow you to have some benchmarks to make those decisions. So we're making, you know, Darrell's point about it's two parts that starts with a requirement. I think we have to figure out how to get that balance right to address the concern that Steve raised that I think a number of people share. And I really like Steve's idea of the field test after doing some further work to distill what it is we give a dry run to do it in one live standard before we start reworking all of them and assess practice after two or three years of how people have worked on it. Because the other bad experience that I think we have to reflect and acknowledge is the disclosure requirement that we have in IS1 right now about the overarching requirement to disclose significant judgments and estimates. I think many of us, when we look at what the response to that has been, it's only used in extremes rather than considered regularly because it's kind of parked off somewhere. And I think this will come back when we look at the paper that has the liens and collateral reworking. But I think what we have to acknowledge those two and say what we're trying to do is two things. And Kimberly basically said this at the beginning. Explain what we mean by material when you're talking about disclosures. And I think it means that instead of presenting what we do today, which is our conclusions, the bullet list of thou shalt disclose, that we have to provide more of our workings in the actual standard so that people have the underlying thinking that so that they can judge against. And then I think the other thing is we do have to come up with less prescriptive language, and we should keep fiddling with that until we get the balance that we think is right. And then we have to spell out probably once in the equivalent of IS1 what it is we're seeking to achieve by doing it this way. And I think we have to spell it out in the standard rather than in the basis. So it's somewhere that people will come across again and again and maybe make a reference at the beginning of each disclosure section in each standard to, in order to apply the overarching requirements in IS1, consider those paragraphs in the context of the following examples kind of thing. But I think it's the right formula. We're playing with words and how we achieve it.
Ian?
Yeah, I found this whole debate on principle-based versus structure very interesting. And I think we come up against it in paper 11E, again, which we'll discuss. And there's two approaches there, and I think one's leaning more to a structured approach and one's more principle-based, and so maybe we can have the debate again as to what. But also I think another thing that's come across to me from Gary and Martin is that large multinationals could well have different problems from smaller companies, and I guess that means in the field testing you've got to be really careful that you have a reasonably broad base in the field testing, so you're taking into account the different situations.
Pat?
Just a quick observation. I also liked what Darrell had suggested, so I think what Mary's summary was quite good. in the context of the practice bulletin on materiality, an observation I made to Christy comes to mind in light of this discussion on how to judge what to put in and what not to put into financial statements, particularly from the preparer's perspective. Sometimes it is easier in the course of the year, I'm sure, for example, at a Deutsche Bank where you may have, I don't know, $25 million of PP&E on a balance sheet of $750 billion or a trillion, right? Clearly not material. But the process of preparing that information, gathering it, is an easy one to have in place, leave in place. And obviously you have to have a decision as to whether or not you should, in accordance with this model, whether or not you put that information in the notes. The concern I have with the practice bulletin, which I raise with you here, is the definition of materiality, in my mind, has to focus and should be entirely focused on the omission of material information. And in this particular case, if a preparer chooses to provide information in the notes, which you, Hans, or you, Gary, whoever, chooses to believe is immaterial, then you can choose to ignore it. What I worry about, the direction in the practice bulletin to some degree, is that someone's going to assert the inclusion of that information clouded the signals that I'm getting and therefore actually was misleading. And I think that's a very dangerous path to go down because, as I said, the investor can choose to ignore the information. So overload of information, in my mind, is not a violation of the materiality principle.
Yeah, but Pat, this makes the whole exercise that we are doing completely useless.
No, what I'm saying is
one of the first things that I've been saying in all my speeches is if something is not material, it's better not to show it. Don't let it.
I don't disagree. What I'm saying is this.
I don't care how many smart analysts there are that immediately delete it from their models. This is what we want to avoid.
What I'm saying is that if a preparer does include it, they shouldn't be crucified. In other words, you can choose to ignore it. I agree. That's the judgment you want to push people towards. But if a preparer makes that judgment,
analysts vastly overestimate their powers.
I just want to fundamentally disagree with Pat and what he just said.
I already did. Okay, Kimberly, you got a very rich feedback, I think, from this discussion. I'm not sure if it's helpful to go through the individual questions, unless there is one that you really want, you know, some more feedback on.
And I was just going to say, the only one that sort of has come up was the one Steve raised, which is question 6 and 7, that word importance, and this is on page 8 of 11F. You know, do you agree that the level of disclosure should depend on relative importance? Then it explains what importance would be, and it tries to give some, you know, its size, nature, and associated risks, and so on. But I think you've got a concern about that, is that right, Steve? We've got to get that wording right.
I do have concern. I was just looking at what we did on IFRS 14, and it's not far away from what's being proposed here. I think there is a better objective. It does use the word consider, but it's in the context of considering the level of detail, how much emphasis, how much aggregation, whether users need additional information. Then it still uses the word shall later on. I just wonder whether we're already moving in this direction.
Yeah, we have. We have.
Well,
we've been doing it for the last 3 or 4 years.
Expected credit losses. And so on.
Yeah.
I think that's reflected in the basis that how the New Zealand team got to where they got to. They looked at what we've done. So what we'd like to do is make sure that it's not just a fluid process. We want to make it more structured and defined.
Okay.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And what time is it over there?
It's 9 p.m.
9 p.m., so it's not yet bedtime, but nevertheless, good night.
Thank you very much. Thanks,
all right.
Thank you.
We take a break for 15 minutes.